Good afternoon. As Bob mentioned, I am Vice President of RDC, and on behalf of the President, Doug Gurney, and all of the Board of Directors, I want to thank you all for coming today, and thank you for your continued support. And to Bob and the staff, thanks for all of your hard work during the past year. We also want to send healing thoughts to Doug and his feeling in his family. Doug is in Boston dealing with some health challenges, and hopefully will be back home soon. So before we turn it over to Bob, who's going to tell us everything we want to know about what happened last year, we've got to do a little bit of business portion. On your table, you should have minutes from last year's annual meeting. And if I could get a motion to accept the minutes from last year's meeting.
So moved, Patty.
Thank you. Second. Is there a second? Thank you, George. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Bob's going to do the treasurer's report.
Thank you. Our treasurer, Nate Cobb, is actually in San Diego, and he was supposed to have recorded something to play, but I don't have it. So here's his report that he wrote. SRDC remains in solid financial shape and had a strong performance in fiscal year 22 due to profitable operations at the Robert S. Jones Center and the main operating fund. Staff funding for COVID relief programs helped to cover additional capacity this past year. Adjustments have been made to ensure continued performance in the operating fund this year and going forward to reflect the fact that those programs no longer exist. The healthy margins in both the Jones Center and operating fund helped to cover ongoing operational losses with the other properties that SRDC owns, particularly the former Bryant Grinder Building and the former Park Street School. SRDC's balance sheet no longer reflects the Vermont Farmstead Cheese Building, which was sold to Great Bear Realty last fall. We still do own the Blake Hill Preserves facility in Windsor through financing to Vita, and that accompanying debt to Vita is still reflected on SRDC's balance sheet. So overall, SRDC had a very positive year financially and remains financially healthy and viable. Thank you.
So now I'd like to turn over to Bob Kendall. He is going to present the election of directors. On behalf of the nominating committee.
Good afternoon, everybody. The nominating committee would like to present the following individuals for open slots on the SRDC board: Patty Putnam, Nate Cobb, and Todd Priestley.
Any other nominations from the floor? All those in favor signify. We need a motion to approve.
So moved.
Thank you. Thanks, George. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Well, there you go, Bob.
All right. Thanks, Patty. And certainly best wishes to Doug. Doug's been having a rough time. He's been down in Boston in the hospital for, over a month now. I think some positive things happening, and hopefully he'll be home here in the next few weeks, and we certainly miss him. Folks, I should recognize from our federal delegation, I see my friend Will Stevens from Senator Bernie Sanders' office. Thank you, Will. And in the way back, John Tracy from Senator Leahy's office. Thank you, John, for coming down. Where's Brett? There's Brett. Brett Long from the Department of Economic Development is with us. Legislators, Allison Clarkson, Dick McCormick. Where's Dick? Right there. And also Representative Christy Martin, who's also on the Springfield Select Board. And next to him is Springfield Select Board member Mike Martin. So before I get to my report, and as well as the other activities of SRDC, one of the projects that we're involved with is the Black River Innovation Campus. It's been an exciting couple of months for that. And to tell us a little more about what's going on at BRIC, I'd like to introduce Marguerite Dibble, who has joined us as the Interim Executive Director of BRIC. Marguerite.
Thanks, Bob. So great to see everybody today. Thank you so much for having me. As Bob mentioned, I've taken over as the Interim Executive Director for the BIC program. It's incredibly fortuitous timing that makes me feel very fortunate, because the team that was in place before I joined, and that is mostly still in place, wrote a very strong grant application, and we have subsequently received a Build to Scale grant, which is really exciting. It basically provides funding from the federal government with matches from the community in Vermont and, you know, locally in Springfield for $3 million and 3 years of operating to achieve the goals that we set out in that grant application. So that's incredibly exciting for us. I feel very lucky that I get to come in at this time and help sort of set some direction so that we can look ahead strategically into the future for the organization. The main goals that I have coming in are to build out a strategic plan that will be able to sustain the organization and help it serve as a catalyst for innovation and vibrancy within the Southern Vermont community. We also are going to be expanding into Randolph, so the efforts that we complete are going to be shared with the group up there, which is really exciting. And it means that we're going to be able to put a lot of attention into how we can actually make these rural Vermont areas feel like hubs for innovation and activity and excitement. And something that's really personally motivating for me is for this to feel like a holistic perspective. I think that the advantage we get in approaching this challenge is to try and put forward first the things that rural Vermont have that no one else does. For me, that's lifestyle. For me, that's a sense of place. For me, that's a creativity and an adventurous spirit and a sense of passion that brings people to these areas. I think if we start with those as foundations and then we build the mission of BRIC, we build the possibilities of BRIC, we build the programming that we offer from that as a starting point, we'll be able to create something that is not only a valuable asset and resource within the state as a whole, but something that's nationally noteworthy and is truly bringing something to the ecosystem of entrepreneurship and startup culture that no one else is. So I'm incredibly happy to be here. I grew up in Landgrove. Who knows Landgrove? No, John does. So it's very rewarding for me. I have a company in Burlington called Game Theory. I built a tech company right out of college. I also serve as the current chair of the board and president of Vermont Public. So it's incredibly rewarding for me to get to come and spend time building something close to home that I hope will provide a vibrancy and a sustainable future for people like me who wanted to grow up and do something with technology, who wanted to have companies and still live in a place like this and embrace all that it has for possibility. So I'm really looking forward to getting to know more of you. So far, it's been a really energizing process. It's been great working with Bob and the rest of the board, and I'm really looking forward to this next chunk of time that we're going to get to spend building out the possibilities. So thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to talk about the Park Street stuff during my report, but one of the bits of serendipity that's come up is a group of Springfield High School alumni from the class of 1968 have formed a fund and a nonprofit to provide funding for coding and other technology-related educational activities through BRIC, through the Springfield School District, and beyond. So we both met with them. They've provided some seed funding already, and they're going to be reaching out to their counterparts around the country from other classes to help try to provide funding not only for the BRIC activities, but for the tech workers of the future. So that's, again, a little bit of serendipity here. So one of the things that SRDC is very, very involved with and has been for many years is workforce development. And that's been the case long before the pandemic and long before the Howard Dean Center, actually way back to our founding. And this is SRDC's 30th anniversary, by the way. So one of the first things Al Moulton did when he founded, as served as the first director, was form the Workforce Investment Board for the region, which is now the River Valley Workforce Investment Board. So that board has kind of been the foundation. I see Sue Graff here, Scott Farr, and there are others with us that serve on the core team of the Springfield Area Working Communities Challenge. So we're in year two of this project, and to tell you more about it is our coordinator, Amanda Sittler.
Okay.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. So as Bob mentioned, the Springfield region has been very fortunate to receive the Working Communities Challenge grant. And for those of you who might not be familiar, the Working Communities Challenge is a three-year grant provided by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. And the Springfield region was one of the first communities to receive this grant in 2021. And actually, Vermont is the first rural state that has received a Working Communities Challenge opportunity. This is a rather unique grant. Each team, each community that you see here has been given the freedom to design their own mission, goals, and strategies around problems that are unique to their communities. And so we're really fortunate to be able to have this opportunity in Springfield. Our mission for the Springfield area team is to increase workforce participation by addressing the systemic barriers that often specifically impact low and moderate income individuals. In other words, we really want to break down the endemic challenges that come with generational poverty. We want to help people fulfill their employment and education goals and create a greater quality of life, but also we want to create a sustainable, solid workforce for our employers to be able to pull from and to flourish.
And I just want to clarify, when I say the Springfield region, I am not just talking about the town of Springfield. I am talking about the 16 towns that are in the Springfield Human Services District. So when I refer to our community, this large geographic area is what I'm referencing. So prior to our receiving this grant, members of our core team that Bob referenced that are here today worked together to identify the sort of most frequent top barriers that often impact employment. And I'm sure for most of these, many of you are familiar with these. You've probably seen them become problems in your own organizations or have heard of these, and were unfortunately most of them severely exacerbated by the pandemic. But these were sort of our guiding star of the focus areas we wanted to address. And again, one of the unique things about this grant is that it is a collaborative process. Many of the organizations here serve in different capacities, and this is not a comprehensive list. I think at this point we have almost 30 organizations and employers that are involved in this process. But as you can see here, they all participate in different capacities. Again, we have core team members here from Agency of Human Services and the River Valley Tech Center, but SRDC functions as the backbone organization. And then everyone participates in different capacities based on the services they provide to the community or the areas of concern that they may have. And although we have identified those sort of five priority barriers that we want to address, the sort of common theme that runs through all of this work is cross-sector collaboration. This is a major tenet of the Working Communities Challenge, the sort of thesis behind why we're doing this work. And we have what we call our no wrong door approach. We want to create a holistic system of support and referral for the people who are experiencing these barriers. And we want to break down the silos that often arise around these challenges. In other words, for an individual, when they encounter one of these barriers, we want them to be able to either go to someone trusted in their job, or maybe it's a service provider, and that person is able to help them solve that problem by going to, they either know who to ask the question to, or they already know what resources are available to them. It's really about making sure that the lines of communication are open and not siloed, and making it easier for those that are most impacted to have access to information quickly. So we actually have a number of initiatives and strategies, and I don't have time to talk about them all today, but I just wanted to feature a few of them for you all. One of our first was our employer resource group. And so this arose sort of out of a necessity during the pandemic. And it's a free monthly workshop open to all employers that are within this region. And our goal is to bring in content experts to help employers address some of the barriers and challenges they may be observing within their own organizations. Both things that are reflected in our work in the Working Communities Challenge, but other things that are identified by the employer community that they want to address. And we really want to provide actionable strategies and tools for employers to take back to their own organizations. And we meet the third Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. We are still meeting virtually. And our next topic for November is going to be on compensation planning for the unknown future of 2023. And so if you haven't seen that invite yet and you would like one, please let me know and I will add you to my exhaustive email list. Okay, and as I mentioned, we have subcommittees that are focused on these different areas, one of which is our Child Care Counts Coalition. And child care is a dynamic problem. I cannot go a whole day without talking about it. One of my other coalition members is here, Sue Graff from Agency of Human Services. And so this group, this subcommittee, is made up of many partners that are a part of the Working Communities Challenge, as well as child care providers, some members from school districts and after school programs. And our goal has really been to try to understand how these primary problems, cost, limited access, and scheduling, how those have impacted not just families, but the other people that are relying on this system, the early childhood education workforce, the providers themselves, and then ultimately the employers. We are all dependent on this system, and unfortunately, it is very broken. And our group is mindful that there are a lot of steps being taken on a national and state level to try to fix some of these things. We know that we cannot fix all of them, but we are trying to create proactive and regionally specific solutions. So, for example, when thinking about supporting the early childhood education workforce, in 2019, Let's Grow Kids did a study around demand for the early childhood education workforce, and it found that in the Springfield region, We needed to increase that workforce by 106%. That's 126 new staff members in the early childhood education field. And that was prior to the pandemic. And I can guarantee you that it is probably much more severe today. I don't have a current number. That study has not been redone yet. But we're trying to find creative solutions to support this specific sector of the workforce, which will then help to alleviate the limited availability. We also want to support and strengthen information sharing and communication. And again, that goes back to that larger goal, that common thread that unites the working community's challenge around network building and breaking down silos. Again, oftentimes there are people that get left out of the childcare sort of conversation. I know for myself, it's been like drinking from a fire hose, learning about all the different dynamics. And again, it's a very challenging problem, but we're trying to create proactive solutions to support our region. And oftentimes, specifically for providers, in a rural region like ours, we are very reliant on both centers, but also rural providers due to infrastructural restrictions. And so we're trying to provide creative resources and solutions for those predominantly female-led small businesses, which are often left out of both that conversation and the childcare narrative on a whole. And so we also have a transportation subcommittee, and which includes, again, members of the larger WCC network. We have members from the Manuscutney Regional Commission, Southeast Vermont Transit, which is the mover, as well as the Vermont Agency of Transportation, and both hospitals have representation on this team. And we have spent the last year or so working on bringing microtransit to the town of Windsor. And I am very pleased to announce that we have received a 3-year grant to make this a reality. Yes. So just for anyone who's unfamiliar, the concept is that we're calling it the micro move. We think that's very clever. It's a free public transportation service, and it will function like Uber. It'll be an on-demand service. And our hope is that it will not only allow people to engage in the community and achieve activities of daily living, like accessing grocery stores, laundromats, but also one of the primary drivers for this was for employment. In the last several weeks, myself and other colleagues that work in the transportation world have received numerous calls around transportation becoming an issue, specifically actually in the Windsor region, which for anyone that's not familiar, we do not currently have public transportation in the town of Windsor. We call it a tweener town because it's in between White River and it's in between Springfield, and it has a relatively small population in comparison to both of those locations. So this will be a very creative solution. It will allow people to be able to get to work. For many of the individuals that I have spoken to and my colleagues have spoken to, they live in town and their employment is also in town and they cannot get to work effectively. So this will hopefully become sort of a solution to alleviate that problem and potentially something that we can model in other rural communities. So we're really excited about it. But I just wanted to highlight this graph over here. One of the things I'm going to explain in a minute is that we have actually designed our own research study. And one of the things that has sort of come out of that is reflected here. The transportation is rapidly becoming a problem. So although we're seeing it right now heavily in the town of Windsor, for the entire region, we're seeing an uptick, which we could attribute to inflation and the current economic climate. But it's something that we all need to be mindful of because it's going to continue to be a problem. And so, as I mentioned, we have also been very fortunate to be able to have our own employment research study. And so essentially in Vermont, we're rural, there are many small towns. It is hard to access accurate and valuable data that represents specifically the region that we're looking at. The lines of Vermont have been drawn very funny. So sometimes very hard for us to grab data. And we actually had a gentleman who is from the region. He currently lives in Boston. He's a data analyst. He approached us about the idea of launching this study. And it's an opportunity for us to ask our community members specific questions around the areas that we're interested in, things that we've seen reflected with employers, but also ask bigger questions around quality of life and just general employment sort of patterns in the community. We launched this study last fall, and so we now have roughly a year's worth of data. And this question up here, do you know your workforce? A colleague of ours in the workforce team, in the WCC team around the state, she mentioned this recently at the New England Summit in Boston. In her observations, The most successful employers are the ones that know their workforce. They look at them and they understand the barriers that they are facing. There are often patterns that we see in certain industries, patterns of challenges that manifest. And her remark was that employers that are proactive and try to address those things for their staff are often more successful in retention and recruitment. And so this concept of do you know your workforce is a common thread among all WCC teams, but I think it's really reflected in our employment research study. We're trying to learn who are the people that are working in our community, who are our neighbors, what are their barriers? And so I just have a couple of pieces of data that I wanted to highlight for all of you, because again, if there's a lot of data, and I don't have time to go over all of it, but just a couple of interesting noteworthy pieces. When we send out the questionnaires, which is done on a bi-monthly basis, we always ask everyone, are you seeking employment? And this response fluctuates. The highest it's been is 30% of respondents. For the September survey, which we just sort of completed collating, it was at 25%. And we also ask respondents, has your employment status changed since the previous survey, which again was only in an 8-week period? And consistently over the last year, 10% of respondents have said, yes, my employment status has changed. We have roughly 110 people who have registered to participate in this study. So at this point, it's going to be a 2-year study, but at this point, over half of our participants in the last year have changed their employment. And for those that respond, I am currently seeking employment, majority of them are already employed. They're the largest proportion of those individuals seeking employment. So these are just things to think about. And we wanted to kind of dive into that more. What is driving this trend? Why are people continuing to look for employment? Because Bob and I are both very aware of, we have a lot of proactive employers in this region that are offering good jobs with substantial benefits. And so we're trying to understand, why are people not going to those jobs? And one of the things that we're seeing frequently, the responses from the surveys are that the jobs do not match my skill set, insufficient pay, and desired schedule. But I think one thing that's really noteworthy about this study is that for those that are unemployed, consistently unemployed, one of their primary remarks is that childcare, 25% of them often remark that childcare is a major contributing factor to them not being able to engage in the workforce. And scheduling as well. Those two things generally go hand in hand. So that's just an interesting thing to be considerate of. I also want to highlight sort of the benefit utilization. We're asking people to characterize the benefits that we're asking people to characterize the challenges that they're experiencing. We ask questions around childcare and transportation, but we also want to understand what benefits are they utilizing, because this kind of helps us understand what is driving employment patterns. We know that those experiencing generational poverty make employment decisions based on previous experience with financial insecurity. The risk of losing benefits that they may rely on to sustain their families will dictate the kind of types of jobs they're attracted to, or whether or not they can even engage in the workforce. And so when I look at this data, although we are seeing a downtrend, which I guess we could think is positive, one of the substantial utilizations is Three Squares and WIC. So that indicates to me that food insecurity is becoming a problem for our community, as well as fuel assistance is on the rise, which makes sense as we enter winter, but also housing assistance has been one of the primaries over the last course of the year. So essentially the reason why I'm sharing all of this data with you is because as we dig through this and try to understand our workforce in the working communities challenge, I challenge those of you that are here representing employers in our community, do you know your workforce? Do you know their needs? As we more closely try to examine the benefits cliff, the Working Communities Challenge across the state is looking at this. As we try to examine this, we will hopefully be able to share that information back with you. But in the meantime, it can be very beneficial for employers to examine their own workforce and the needs that they have. And maybe we want to be able to reward people that are hard workers, that are consistent, and that show up. But you may be putting that individual at risk of losing things that they're relying on to sustain their family. Some creative solutions I've seen from employers in our region are things like offering food at work. So for those that are food insecure, they can rely on that meal and they can engage more fully in their work. but also other employers have tried to utilize parents' hours, creating flexible schedules around the parents' needs and working with them, as well as offsetting costs for childcare, as well as things like phone bills. Those creative solutions can be the thing that drives an individual to choose an employer. It is both a strategy for retention and developing that employee loyalty, but also it can be a very competitive recruiting strategy. So I appreciate all of you listening to me discuss all of this working communities challenge stuff. And again, I challenge you to think, how can I better understand my workforce? And I hope that maybe some of you are interested in engaging with us in this further. And if you would like to join the Working Communities Challenge team to dive more fully into this work, please let me know. I'd be happy to share more information because, again, we have a mountain of data. But thank you again, all. And if also we have a webpage on the SRDC website that outlines more of what we're working on. And we have a Facebook page where I update things regularly for events and such. So thank you all.
It's funny, you know, you think about, well, why is an economic development organization spending so much time on talking about benefits and things like that? Well, the lines blur. And I think the lines have gotten real blurry and real squishy and have kind of all melded into one over the past couple of years since the pandemic. Because at the end of the day, we're all people. And these are our friends and neighbors as well as quote-unquote workforce. So it's incumbent upon all of us to work collaboratively on trying to address the various barriers and challenges and opportunities. So Amanda's doing a wonderful job with the Working Communities Challenge. Thanks. Okay, I got to switch PowerPoints. Escape from this. This. Okay, back. There we go. Okay, it's full screen for you. Good. So as I said, it's our 30th anniversary. That one kind of snuck up on us. So here are the things I'm going to be going over. We're going to talk about the properties we own. We're going to talk about some of the activities we're involved with in Windsor. Also the project priority list, the work we did with our CARES Act revolving loan fund and some other activities. But note the quote at the bottom, and I'm going to kind of come back to this one a couple of times. The Regional Development Corporations, or RDCs, were one of 12 in the state, have always viewed themselves as the one-stop shop. And we'll talk about our partners in a second. But the idea is anybody who comes into our office, whether it's the single person looking to start a business or the largest employers and everybody in between, we're there to help them. And we have partners who can help them, such as Deborah, such as Ed, as well as being the kind of conduit to the products and resources from the State Department of Economic Development or other partners that can help their project be successful. That has become also more acute and more pronounced during the pandemic. We are serving a broader range of businesses and people than we ever have before. So I'm going to come back to this slide in a second, but show time for pictures. So this is the infamous J&L Plant 1 on Clinton Street. These are pictures of what it was historically. This is where it was about a year ago with part of the building demoed. And that's what it looks like now. So we'll come back and talk about where we are with that here. So the building's down. Hooray. This part of the building is still there, and that end is the home of LBL Fabrications. If you were to drive by more closely, you would see there is bracing currently right here holding up that wall, and there's still some black stuff you can sort of see here on the roof. This was taken like a week ago on an aerial shot. Actually, more like over here. So before winter, we say optimistically, the hope is that we get some work done on this wall so the bracing can go away and the wall can stand on its own. And we remove some of the black material on the roof, which has asbestos in it. Stone Environmental, Dan's not here, is he? Stone Environmental currently is doing assessment work on the bad stuff under the slab. If you've ever been in my office, I have a rendering of this on my wall that shows a lot of different colors, and the pretty colors are all the different pollutants on this site. This is probably easily the most complex brownfield site in the state of Vermont. To date, with the money that's been spent on the demo and the various cleanup that's been spent before that, we're over $7 million. And we've got a couple million still to go. So obviously it wasn't super safe to check out the slab with the building about to fall on you. So now that the building's gone, they're doing the assessment work on the slab. They will update what's called the corrective action plan. That will get approved by the Department of Environmental Conservation. And then if we are able to secure some funding, the slab comes up next year. Okay, so updates on the JNL demo project. We have a dedicated webpage on our website where I post updates frequently about the project. I also have a frequently asked questions page, such as, what's going to go there, Bob? And Bob says, what's not going to go there, such as a dog park, such as a jousting ring. People have asked about those, believe it or not. Across the street from JNL, where's my drawing here? This is a parking lot that years ago was an employee parking lot. SRDC owns that as well, and that property is under contract to a company that wants to build a Dunkin' Donuts on that site. So we would use that money, obviously, to go back into our expenses on the property. And then after the slab is taken up, we start to market the property. So this is actually going in Images magazine in the winter issue. We just designed this last week. So starting to tease out, at the end of the day, it's not just taking down a building. It's not just cleaning up a brownfield site. It's 12 acres of flat land on a four-lane highway with full utilities near the interstate. And people sort of, at least locally, will say, what on earth's ever going to want to go there? We already have inquiries. And we haven't even really marketed this yet. At the end of the day, if we can deal with all the nonsense and all the pollution and the contamination, this is valuable property, and we've got to be very thoughtful and intentional about what goes on this property so it can best benefit the region economically. So this is our start of telling the story of the property. Marguerite spoke about Park Street earlier. So some things on the Park Street front. So Park Street School, the former Park Street School, is where the Black River Innovation Campus is located. That would ideally be one of the anchor tenants of this 100,000-foot building, which would also include space for the town to continue to use the historic gymnasium. There is a beautiful auditorium that we hope to restore to be the town's sort of opera house, a 500-seat auditorium. The Springfield School District still uses the property for its central offices. We hope that would continue. We also hope that there is some housing over in this part of the building that I'll speak about in a second. So one of my terms of art is sausage making. You don't want to know how it's made, you just like the end product. So we're putting together the sausage for Park Street now. So in the past year, we were awarded a $3 million congressionally directed funding opportunity, AKA earmark, from HUD. Thank you, John, and Senator Leahy's office for making that happen. And we're about to actually receive those funds to put that to work. We received a $1.2 million brownfield grant from the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, a $500,000 community development block grant through the town of Springfield for code-related work in the building. And there are other puzzle pieces that we received prior to this as well, and we're hoping to combine those in some form to go out to bid to do some work on the property over the winter to at least start to make some progress. We need a lot more. One of the pieces that has been very maddening for us on this, and my friends in the legislature have heard me go on about this, is housing. The state has spent an awful lot of money on housing the last couple of years. It has not been at all useful for this project because we would have to swallow hard and accept permanently affordable covenants, which really don't work for what this project is. We proposed some language that my friend Mr. Dunn, who's not here yet, but is supposed to be, proposed that for people that are entrepreneurs or within a certain income range when they start entrepreneurial training or coding training or remote work training could live in these units. We weren't able to get that through, but we are going to be making another run at it this coming winter. So don't worry, you'll be hearing from us.
We just heard from
you. You'll be hearing more. We spend a lot of time in Windsor. So Springfield, Windsor, and Chester provide funding to us to serve as their de facto town staffs. Heather Hartford's not here, but she's not here because she's a new grandmother. Her daughter gave birth to twins yesterday.
Wow.
So everybody's healthy and well. So I allowed her to skip the meeting. So anyways, Heather's our point person in Windsor. We manage the former Goodyear property, which is now called the River Street Commerce Park, and the Windsor Resource Center. Windsor Improvement Corporation, another WIC, is the entity that is the local development corp in Windsor that we also administer, and they own those properties. Heather wrote a successful application for $50,000 in downtown tax credits for code-related work at the River Street Commerce Park facility. And the picture is of a project that we are assisting Evernorth and Windsor Wyndham Housing Trust in doing, which is a 25-unit, $12 million affordable housing project in downtown Windsor. that has so far received support from Vermont Housing Finance Agency, Vermont Housing Conservation Board. It's on the docket for a community development block grant in a couple of weeks and currently going through the local zoning process. So that would be an exciting, as they call it, infill project. This is property behind the Windsor Diner, if you've ever been to downtown Windsor, that has just been sitting there. It's basically a lot of dirt that slopes downhill. This would fill in that place and would be a real interesting project for the community of Windsor. So J&L, Park Street, the Goodyear, the Central and Main project, all of those and others are on the regional priority project list, which is a process that all of the regional development corporations and regional planning commissions undertake every year to put the projects that are the highest priority in their region on a list. That list is taken into consideration by entities such as the Agency of Commerce or Northern Borders Regional Commission or others when they're making funding decisions. So we're compiling this year's list. The deadline is coming up on Friday. Both our site and the Mount Escutney Regional Commission site has information on it, including an application. The Springfield Area Parent-Child Center got on the list last year. They were awarded an NBRC grant to purchase the property next to them to do an expansion. The locals would know it as KJ's. So they got on the list. That was helpful in having them receive this grant to do this project. We can add projects anytime during the year. We submit it to the state once a year, but we do keep an active list. Oops. So COVID programs are pretty much winding down, although there's a VITA forgivable loan program right now and some other stuff. One that we were really proud to be a part of was the Springfield Area CARES Act Revolving Loan Fund. So we have a regular revolving loan fund program, but we applied for and were awarded $500,000 from EDA, and EDA did a good job with this one. So we were able over the past couple of years to distribute over $450,000 to the area businesses you see listed there. So that includes businesses that were closed and are reopening because of this, the Hartness House being an example of that. Businesses that are expanding, Vermont Try and Cure Technologies, needed some cash flow. JC's Market and Deli is in the former North Springfield Market that shut down during the pandemic. These are new owners, locals. They did the work with Small Business Development Center and Deborah, who was involved in all of these, actually. And they are now kind of the heart of the village of North Springfield. All of these are really cool success stories. Voy, the last one listed, is one of the businesses that currently is housed in the Black River Innovation Campus. We are able to provide them funding because one of the businesses that received the earlier funds paid their loan back. So we've been able to distribute actually close to $500,000 from this. And as I said at the beginning, we continue to work with an incredible variety of businesses and business concepts, even more so than we have, trying to help them, handhold them through various programs. That's part of what Amanda does as well, and trying to help them get through. So speaking of other ways we've assisted area businesses, Simon Pierce in Windsor, the Windsor location, is expanding their glass blowing operation. So we help them, I didn't get my page here. There we go. We helped them with an application for a Vermont Employment Growth Incentive that they received in June. This past weekend, we found out that our application for a Buildings and General Services small grant to help purchase some of the equipment for the glass blowing equipment was awarded. And we're currently assisting them with a Vermont Training Program application. Vermont Training Program is one of those that we work with John Young on from the Department of Economic Development all the time. Lovejoy is here somewhere. Where's Todd? Todd Priestley from Lovejoy, they received a Vermont Training Program grant this past year. And applications for other programs, it's our job to know the alphabet soup and to try and translate it and make it user-friendly for the businesses. One of whom, my friend David Jacks is sitting here from 10 Volts Engineering. They were the project in this region that was awarded a capital investment grant of $500,000. So congratulations, David's doing some really cool and exciting things in the former Hancor building in North Springfield, and hopefully that will help to that project to move forward. And finally, Amanda mentioned, you know, we mentioned workforce development, the Working Communities Challenge. I think she referenced Working Fields, which is a project to help people that are in recovery from substance use get back into the workforce. It acts as kind of a temp agency for those people to de-risk it for the employer. So they're currently working with several employers in the region. We've served as kind of the matchmaking entity for that. Scott Farr, Scott right in front of me from the River Valley Tech Center, They're one of our close partners in workforce development. We and they and the other partners in the WIB are involved in putting together the area job fair. Suffice to say that workforce development takes up a lot of our time because without a workforce, there is no business. I want to thank our partners, many of whom I've mentioned, obviously the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, Department of Economic Development, Department of Environmental Conservation, which is our partner in a lot of the brownfields projects, Deborah from the Small Business Development Center, and Ed from Procurement Technical Assistance Center, which helps you with government contracting. They work in our office or virtually, but they're still people we interface with every day. The Vermont Manufacturing Extension Center. We mentioned our legislator. We mentioned the communities. My friends from the regional commission are over there, Jason Rasmussen and Tom Kennedy. They're probably our closest partner and are involved in many of the projects we've just spoken about, as well as everybody on the list and in this room, and VITA, obviously. It takes a team to do all this stuff, and we are grateful for the relationships and partnerships we have, and we're grateful for the work that we're able to do. Obviously, the businesses that are members of SRDC, thank you for sticking with us. We mentioned Doug earlier, and we know he's on the mend, and all the members of the board. George is here, but Ethan McNaughton and George Lamb take care of us legally. Steve Veroff take care of us financially, and our great staff. We mentioned Heather's in Florida. You saw Sandy when you came in. You met Amanda. Bob LaPlante takes care of our buildings, is our property guy, along with Donnie Griswold in Windsor. Cynthia Porter and Joanne Jackson take care of our financials in the office. So that's where you can find out more information about us. Facebook, still on Twitter for the moment, our website. And obviously, thank you all for your continued support and allowing us to try and make great things happen in the area. Thank you. Okay, so time to turn it over to our featured speaker. And I think when we were looking at the topic, we knew we wanted to do something related to workforce development, and there's something very exciting going on in the state that you're about to hear more about, which is the transformation of the state college system into something that will be called the Vermont State University. So I heard a briefing about this with my fellow RDC directors a few months ago, and grateful that our guests were able to join us today. So Sophie Zadatny is the chancellor of the Vermont State College System. She's been there since 2020. She's been with the VSC since 2014 after working in the legal profession in and out of Vermont. And Dr. Parwinder Graywal will serve as the inaugural president of the new Vermont State University when it launches next summer. He comes to Vermont from the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, where he served in several key leadership roles. So, Sophie and Parwinder, if you could join us up here, please. Tell us more about the exciting things going on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think I'll probably start, and then I'm going to pass it over to Parwinder. So thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I'm sorry Pat Moulton is not here. I realize that there's a long history here with Pat and her family, and I just heard about Al Moulton. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm sure Pat will be connecting with you in very short order. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about the transformation that we've been going through at the Vermont State Colleges, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Graywal to really share with you his vision for Vermont State University and what we're going to be doing moving forward. So higher education's been going through a massive disruption and upheaval, as you're probably aware, and particularly here in New England, you know, we face demographic challenges, we face challenges, technology challenges. You know, we have SNHU, Southern New Hampshire University, on our border, you know, delivering online programming. You know, the model, I think, for higher education really needs to change, and we've been given that opportunity to make that change because of the crisis that we faced 2.5 years ago. So the former chancellor had really started studying these issues and had put out a white paper outlining the challenges facing the Vermont State College system in 2019. Again, higher education moves very slowly. I'll share, my husband is a faculty member at the University of Vermont. He's a history professor. So one of my favorite quotes is that it's actually easier to change the course of history than a history course. So, you know, it's not easy to do this stuff. But the fact that we got to a point of crisis really enabled us to make changes that really would have been unimaginable 3 years ago in 2019. If I was standing here and was and knew all the things that were coming, I would have thought it was absolutely impossible. So when COVID came, we were facing a financial crisis. We'd been heading in that direction for a long period of time, but COVID really accelerated it for us because we knew we needed to refund the students that were all sent home. We needed to refund their room and board tuition, and it was really going to just put us right at the brink. There was an announcement made to shutter three of our courses, including the Randolph campus for Vermont Technical College. The state stepped in. There was huge outpouring across the state around the importance of the Vermont State College system. The state stepped in and said, don't do that. And then the select committee was created, a legislative select committee. And I don't know how what the track record is for select committee reports and how successful they are. I suspect most of them land up, you know, holding doors open somewhere. This one was really unusual because it was unanimous recommendations, well supported. We had representatives from business. We had representatives from other higher education agencies, from the state, from the legislature, the governor's office. It was a really well done committee. We had an external assistance from an external company that was hired through the Joint Fiscal Office who came in. And there was recognition that really we, the Vermont State Colleges, were not crying wolf. We really were genuinely in a very serious financial situation. The recommendations of the Select Committee report, there were a number of them. The two really big ones for us were bringing together three of our four institutions. So that's the Castleton University, Vermont Technical College, and Northern Vermont University, and then maintaining the Community College of Vermont separately. The other big recommendation was we needed to do aggressive administrative consolidation and just bring all the sort of back office stuff together, and that would also include the Community College of Vermont. In exchange, it was, you know, the report listed the support that we should be receiving from the state moving forward and also identified that we needed to achieve $25 million in structural deficit reduction over a five-year period. And we're kind of in, I think, year two now that we're moving forward. So for higher ed, we're moving at an incredibly fast speed. I know if you were probably, you know, private business, you could do this way faster than we can do it. But, you know, higher education is just a challenge to do that. But again, tremendous progress has been made. So one of the big, huge pieces, obviously, is bringing together the three institutions. So hiring Dr. Graywall was absolutely critical for us in moving this forward. So he's serving currently as the president of the three separate institutions, and then we'll be launching Vermont State University next summer. So just to be clear, because I know it's very confusing, Vermont State Colleges will continue to exist, but it will be comprised of two organizations, two institutions as we move forward. So it'll be the Community College of Vermont and Vermont State University. And then one of the things I think that's really important to emphasize here and for you guys is we really see workforce development as being absolutely critical for the Vermont State Colleges moving forward. And we've historically done a lot of workforce development, particularly through Vermont Tech and through CCV, but a lot of that's been sort of off to the side. It hasn't been sort of the main focus of the campuses and what we do. And I think we recognize that through this process, if we're going to receive the additional support from the state that we need, and again, I will say we are extremely grateful for the support we've already received, but this is an ongoing process as we move forward. If we're going to receive that support, we really, really need to make sure that we're serving Vermont. Our mission is for the benefit of the state of Vermont, and that we take that very seriously. And I think as we move forward, workforce is one of those key pieces. So Pat Moulton, the former president of Vermont Tech, and I guess the former executive director of SRDC, she is serving now as the executive director for workforce development for the system. So she will be having an externally facing role. She will be working with you, will be working with businesses to really identify what employers need and what we at the Vermont State Colleges can deliver and help support workforce moving forward. So we really see this as a critical piece moving ahead. Our Board of Trustees has recognized this is critically important, and so this position is a system position and we'll be reporting directly to our Board of Trustees. So I really wanted to make that point so all of you were aware of that. So again, Pat will certainly, I'm sure, be reaching out to you. She'll be looking for any of those opportunities, things we can do, and then she'll be bringing that back to the two presidents, Dr. Graywall and then Joyce Judy at the Community College of Vermont. And I'm going to let Dr. Graywall come and share with you, because I know one of the reasons Dr. Graywall was selected for this position was his vision for workforce and his commitment to that for us moving forward.
Thank you very much for having us here today. And after listening to and seeing all the successes that you are having in bringing in so many grants, I believe that this is the place to be. And, and this is the organization that we need to engage in more seriously. As Chancellor Zatetny has shared, you see the background in which I'm coming to serve as the president. I went to Harvard for a training for new presidents, and all 58 new presidents and the veteran presidents who came to teach us, they all told me, open, clearly, that you have the toughest job in the nation. So that's my challenge. But that said, somehow this challenge of closing the campuses was framed in such a good way. They all called it transformation. And in higher education, the opportunity for transformation is rare. We move so slowly. The stakes are small, but they're really big in academia. So with that background, the system is shaken, and we are in a place that we could build something really big if we act collectively and work together. So with that background, what I did starting from my day one, I went on a listening tour to all these different campuses. People are anxious because they don't know whether their campus will still exist, whether the faculty or staff will have jobs. They still have those in the background. So with that listening sessions and all the research that the system has already done and the transformation project they started, we developed three top priorities for the new university. Those three priorities will set this university to be a unique, very different university and a modern university that it should be. Our first and foremost, you can hear me okay in the back there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The first and foremost is for us to become a statewide hybrid university. That would be the first in the nation. What that means is student can start in any of the campuses, can have access to faculty and programs on any other campus if they so choose to do so. Furthermore, we have 17 sites in which we offer our nursing program, which is one of the largest programs. So we are hoping even at those sites, the students could begin and make progress towards their degree. This is the core idea for that, is to enhance access to non-traditional students into higher education. All campuses were residential campuses, so only those folks who can stay on campus, pay for residential expenses, could access higher education. Doing it this way, people who otherwise are working, want to go for higher education, can now would have access to higher education. That's our first and topmost priority, and that's part of the committee's report as written, as Chancellor mentioned. The second priority that we set up based on the listening sessions and our prior experience is to set this university as a community-engaged university, that this university would be people's university, would be community's university. Community members, and many of you, vouched for the system to survive. And it is the onus is upon this new university that we engage with our local communities, wherever our campuses are and beyond, and deliver some value to local communities. So the idea for that is that our faculty, staff, and students working together with local community partners, like we heard today, and figuring out co-developing solutions to local problems. It will prepare our students for workforce on day one, right after they graduate, because they would have experienced working with real people, collecting data, real people working on some real problems. The second, it will enhance faculty members' capacity to do applied research. They could even publish some of this work if they work together in this. It will inspire students and make them more attached to their local community and to the university, therefore could enhance retention. But even bigger benefit of that would be that those students who get inspired about the community engaged work, they might choose to stay in that community. We might retain them in local communities. That's the intellectual capital that we want to build moving forward. They could start their nonprofits, they could start their businesses right in their community on the ideas that they would have developed through this collaborative work. So that's the second piece. Already in Linden, an alum had given that Linden College before it, after it became Northern Vermont University, to start a learning and working community. That's a alum gave $3.5 million. That is one of the ideas that we want to take further into this community-engaged university so that our students can actually do real work for employers while they're getting the degree, and that work is part of their degree curriculum. It's not something extra that they have to do. That's the second piece. The third priority we have is to set this university right from the start as a career-ready university. Not that it is something that is the outcome of education, but we have the education in a way that the student is ready once they graduate for work. How are we going to do that? No matter what degree program they are in, history was mentioned, political science or other programs, where the student, after they graduate, they don't see a direct link to work. Even in those degree programs, we plan to embed micro-credentials that are industry relevant in every degree path, so that every student has something to fall back on or be more prepared for the jobs. So including the community-engaged scholarship and learning and these micro-credentials embedded throughout the degree programs, our students will be more workforce ready. So these are our three top priorities. Now coming to the workforce development. Workforce development is one of my passions, and I served on McAllen Economic Development Corporation, just like your corporation. And our goal there was, I was serving on the board, and to bring in new industries to that region. Every month we had meetings, and presentation the staff would make would be, these are 10 companies that we are bringing to this area. These are 20 companies we are talking about bringing over here. These five companies have already agreed to come to our city. That kind of work was being done on a basically regular basis. So that said, the workforce development can be a word that some of my colleagues in especially liberal arts would say that it is not what the university is about. But that's something that we are going to have to change moving forward. That one, every student that comes to the university wants to do something with their life, whether it is finding a job or, you know, somebody might say, I'm gonna become a writer. But that's a profession too. To me, that's workforce as well. want to be a politician. That's workforce as well. So broadly defining workforce. Second, the workforce-related activities, the micro-credentials I mentioned, and other benefits that we have. We have a small development, small business development center that's based in Randolph. We have VMAC, which is also based in one of our campuses, Randolph. These folks do outward-looking work. They are helping so many businesses succeed and manufacturers get to a better place. We want to engage them internally also so that our students, that the future workforce, is also more ready for that. Having micro-credentials like entrepreneurship, where engineering students learn about this and they could be actually starting their businesses while they are in school because they developed something, a new idea that their professors helped them succeed in, and they could be supported to start their businesses. And that is the type of approach that we want to take with the new university. Then finally, with Senator Leahy's help, we have a $10 million new investment in the Advanced Manufacturing Center. That center not only has workforce-related activities, that means training folks on these new types of machines, and many people have already started to come in, including Army, have already showed up on our campus to get their employees trained. But we are hoping that we would be able to seed new businesses using that particular center. This center has 3D printers of the size that you could actually do metal part printing. It's not just for education, it is actually manufacturing scale that large. We are hoping that we could contract out work using these machines to businesses who want to get into that kind of area and want their work done or test it at a pilot scale, we would be able to do that. And if a small manufacturer want to develop some products and feel the market, we should be able to do that as well. So that is another way to do economic development in the region, in addition to the work that's already being done with the Small Business Development Office and VMAC. These are some of the things that I wanted to highlight, and I wanted to also keep it open so that it can be conversational. So we are open to questions. We are here today to answer any questions, and we want to build those partnerships. We want to bring in our faculty and students to your areas so that we can do work together. We want to leverage any intellectual capital that the university has with you as equal partners to develop regional economic development and workforce. So appreciate the chance to talk to you today.
And as Dr. Graywall said, he'd be happy, or Sophie would be happy, to take any questions now, or perhaps speak to you after the meeting. But anybody have any immediate reaction or questions? I saw Sue first, then George. Sue?
Just encourage with the low residency, it sounds like, you know, with the hybrid schedule, hybrid format, sounds amazing, all good, to consider workforce housing considerations. So when the universities and the campuses have assets, think about utilizing them for your own workforce, particularly with housing, because that's one of the biggest challenges with attracting and retaining our workforce. So I'd love to see you be an active partner in that, helping us to solve those problems.
Absolutely, and that's where we are headed. In that report that the Chancellor mentioned, there is the talk about right-sizing and how we can make our facilities available for local businesses. And you mentioned for our own workforce, right? Because housing has become quite critical in the state. It makes a lot of sense to go in that direction. With the Randolph Center, as I mentioned, creating an incubator for small new businesses that would be around that advanced manufacturing center. We have space. We have lab space. They could start right there, you know, with 2, 3, 4 employees and work with the center.
Thanks, yeah. George.
My question is, where do you see your tuition for this new institution and the availability of resources, loans, or grant scholarships for people at the lower end of the food chain, the economic
Right. So the first action that we have taken, the university is not even fully functional yet, but we worked with the board, and we have set a new tuition for the incoming students, and it also already reduced tuition. We have reduced our tuition to below $10,000, so therefore making the university's program accessible to more students. That's the first step. The second, the aid that we have been providing, we also want to repackage that aid in a way that it goes more to the needy students. So first, lowering the basic tuition for both in-state and out-of-state students. Out-of-state students, it will be less than 20,000, so we would be more competitive. And then adding any additional aid to those students who need it.
Just one follow-up for advice. Has there been any discussion or consideration of students that borrow incur indebtedness to go if they stay in Vermont and they work for a number of years, some type of forgiveness program? I know that.
We would be looking into those kinds of programs. We have had discussions with the governor and even with Senator Leahy's staff and Sanders' staff. There are opportunities to bring in people probably from outside as well and retain them here using similar type of programs to entice them in a way that here is some support, but you're going to have to work in this area for a certain number of years and such.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I just want to add that part of our workforce package this year was, I can't remember how many millions we put into it, but for people who commit to staying, they get loan forgiveness.
Thank you.
I would just add, too, the Community College of Vermont has a number of programs and philanthropic support to help support students. But in particular, there's the 802 opportunity grant through VSAC, where if the family's adjusted gross income is $75,000 or less, they essentially get to go to the Community College of Vermont for free. So we did find with a lot of the funding that we received from the state over the past couple of years, we were able to pilot a number of programs and provide free tuition or reduced tuition, and Vermonters flock to doing it. So we know that cost is a barrier for our institutions. I did want to just quickly follow up on the the buildings as well. There is some complexity for us in divesting of the buildings that we're in. Again, we have a lot of deferred maintenance. We have excess capacity for residential halls, but they're not easily converted to other purposes like elder housing or whatever. We've had people come in and look at them, but you know, you'd have to install elevators, and the bathrooms are, you know, group bathrooms that people aren't interested in. So we're trying to be as creative as we can on the buildings, but it's not easy for us because some of them are collateral for bonds and we've used capital dollars on them. So that's part of our long-term strategy. That's not something we can do overnight, but I 100% agree in terms of being creative in terms of can we provide housing, particularly for young faculty coming in, because we're not alone, but obviously a lot of institutions of higher education in Vermont have really struggled to recruit faculty because of the housing crisis. So if we could provide the opportunity for faculty to live on campus for the first couple of years or whatever, that could be a real benefit.
Just to tag on to the financial aid piece, I work for VSAC, so we're a nonprofit in Vermont. So with the tuition being below $10,000 a year, a full aid eligible student who might qualify for a full Pell Grant and a full Vermont Grant, some of our lowest income students, those two grants together are covering the tuition, which is quite amazing. And then we're working with students for additional scholarships and supports, maybe forgivable loans to help if there are housing or other needs. So there are already some great resources in place for some of our students with the most need. And as you were expressing, the 802 Opportunity Scholarship is helping so many families and so many individuals with getting their first 2 years of college for free. And then we're really excited to help those students transition towards, say, a bachelor's degree in this new system, rather than stopping at that two-year point. There are so many more opportunities with this. We're really excited. And I'll say families who are looking for support with this, we have counselors around the state, and we will work with them one-on-one for free to help with navigating some of these complicated systems and help them put their financial aid together.
Yeah, I would say VSAC's a great partner. The other piece is the McClure Foundation has provided a three-year program to CCV. So if any student does early college, they will then guarantee that the second year, because the early college is essentially free to the student, but the McClure Foundation will then pay for the second year, so they would be able to get an associate. So what these programs are really aimed to do is really increase the number of students that graduate from high school and go on to college, because we don't do so well as a state on that front.
All right. Other questions, Ed?
Yeah, just tying in, as a graduate of VTC and having been placed in a job and placed very well, as were many of my classmates, and then going further to Boston Architectural Center down in Boston, where there was a model of work and learn. And I'm wondering if there's a way of working, or if you've thought on and been in dialogues with working with employers and industry to where your students are getting credit for the work that they're doing while they're learning and being trained, and can very often then stay with that employer as almost a workforce development incentive.
Absolutely, and this is where we are headed, and this, as I said, should not be extra work for the student to gain on their own. It should be embedded into their degree programs. There have to be credit for this, and all these things need to be configured in a way that it is beneficial both sides, the university as well as the student and the employer that is employing that student at that time. So the learning and working community, the concept is exactly the same that came out of the Lyndon College. And we want to expand that to be working with industry, local schools, and also local city governments, you know, nonprofit organizations. They all need help. Sometimes it's just about grant writing or whatever the case may be. These students can be empowered to do that kind of work. Furthermore, we are hiring an associate vice president for workforce, community, and economic development. That is the title for this person that we are looking for right now. The idea there is exactly that this person will connect our students and faculty to community organizations that are doing great work and need help. And students and faculty will work with them in partnership to be able to deliver and develop new things in each and every community. And that's an amazing way to learn, hands-on experience, and be inspired. And that is the way we are setting up this new university.
Yeah. Dick.
Yes.
Has the various state colleges come together as one institution?
Yes.
And the community college remains separate. What do you envision as the relationship between the community colleges and the state college?
That's a very good question. And right now, myself as the incoming president for the Vermont State University, and Joyce Judy, who is our president for CCV, we work very well together. On many things, we think alike, and the relationship is going to be such that direct transfer of students minimize hurdles of students transferring from that college to VTSU. That's one. The second is the relationship through this workforce development office, which would be based in the chancellor's office. So our goal there is to share the workforce development activities through Pat Moulton's office. That means if university can deliver a project more efficiently, university will deliver that. If CCV can deliver something more efficiently, then they will deliver it. So we will work, hopefully, seamlessly. Now we are only two organizations. We would know who is creating trouble. So it should be a much better partnership. As long as I'm there, I think I don't see a problem in terms of working together on many aspects. There would be so many things the university can do at the higher end. You talk about professional development of employees to increase productivity of our employees, managers, right? That the university can do a much better job at the higher level. But at the lower level, workforce development training, CCV is already doing a wonderful job. And why compete, right? It's just one organization overall, one system.
All right, perhaps one more?
Yeah.
And if not, thank you, Dr. Graywall. Thank you, Sophie. And I'm sure they'll be happy to chat afterwards.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.